985-5735, 818-985-KPFK, or hit the donate button at kpfk.org. Thank you.
This is KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, and at kpfk.org for the world.
Good afternoon, friends. Good afternoon, and welcome to this week's edition of the Lawyers Guild Show. I'm Jim Lafferty. My co-host Maria Hall is not with us today, but that's for a very good reason. Maria is being honored as getting one of the Hero Awards from California Safe Schools, and that's because of the work she did environmentally with helping to get our schools are often the last places to get cleaned up. And yet our children are in them for many hours a day. So she's getting an award today from California Safe Schools, a Hero Award for her work in that regard. So congratulations to Maria Hall. She'll be back with us again next week. In the meanwhile, we've got a great show for you today. And our first half hour, we're going to be talking with a housing rights attorney about the abysmal situation of the unhoused here in our community and, frankly, throughout our country. And in the last half hour, we'll be talking with one of the spokespersons for Black Lives Matter LA as to how they feel about the nomination by Mayor Karen Bass of Jim McDonnell to be the new police chief of LA. Surprise, surprise, they're not happy about that, and we'll find out why. Well, it's going to come as no surprise, of course, to anyone living in Los Angeles, with their eyes at least half open anyway, that the numbers of unhoused residents in our state and city just keep growing. Oh, there may be a few less without even some temporary shelter available to them, but despite billions, really, think about being approved by voters here in the state to do something about the problem of the unhoused, nothing truly meaningful has yet been done. There are at least 186,000 unhoused in California, and that's an 8% increase over the last couple of years. There are 75,000 plus right here in LA, and nationwide over, my God, 650,000 unhoused. Once upon a time in the United States, the government, you know, used to do a bit, not enough, but did something with respect to public housing. I mean, I grew up in Detroit, Michigan, and at that time in Detroit, there were a hell of a lot of folks who would have been living in those tent cities we see all over our town had it not been for those public housing buildings scattered throughout the city built by the government. But public housing, I'm afraid, is pretty much a thing of the past in the United States today. Frankly, I've yet to learn of anything today that makes me optimistic where the matter of the unhoused sisters and brothers is concerned. And this is despite the fact that there are hundreds of truly heroic people and groups working night and day against great odds and under truly difficult conditions to turn this shameful situation around. And they are clearly fighting an uphill battle, though, here in capitalist America, where profits, not human rights, rule the day. Well, one of these very fine crusaders for justice for the unhoused is our guest today. Her name is Kath Rogers. Ms. Rogers is a staff attorney at the ACLU of Southern California, serving on that organization's SoCal Dignity for All project, where she works to advance the rights of unhoused community members through litigation and policy advocacy. Now, prior to working at the ACLU, Kath Rogers was an adjunct professor at the University of Southern California, where she helped launch a one-of-its-kind undergraduate clinical law program. She's previously been in private practice as well, where she focused on civil rights cases. And I'm proud to say that Kath Rogers has served some years back as a very dynamic executive director of the National Lawyers Guild chapter here in LA. So, Attorney Kath Rogers, a warm welcome back to the Lawyers Guild Show.
Thanks so much, Jim. It's always good to see you and be here with you.
Absolutely. We're pleased to have you, Kath. Kath, I wonder, was my introduction to our topic unfairly bleak? I mean, I certainly didn't present it as though there was, anything great being done with respect to the unhoused. Is it as bad as I suggested?
Well, I agree with your assessment that it's bleak. We're the richest nation on earth, and we're surrounded by wealth and, millionaires, and there are people forced to live on the street. And so I don't think you're being too bleak at all. I think there's bright spots in our movement, when we get together to demand change, but I don't disagree.
All right. Well, and just lately, it just seems like they keep building these obstacles higher and higher for folks like you, and for, more importantly, our unhoused sisters and brothers. But one big, very big blow to the rights of the unhoused has recently occurred as a result of a horrid decision by the U.S. Supreme Court in the case of Grants Pass versus Johnson. Tell our audience, and we talked about this on the Lawyers Guild show in some detail a while ago, but remind our audience of what Grants Pass v. Johnson did. What was that case about?
Yeah, well, I certainly agree with your characterization of it as a horrid decision by our Supreme Court. This ruling came down in June earlier this year, and it basically removes an important legal protection for unhoused people. This is the federal constitutional protection against cruel and unusual punishment. Mm-hmm. So the court basically ruled that the Eighth Amendment doesn't apply where local governments punish people for engaging in life-sustaining activities related to their unhoused status. So that might be, someone who's sleeping outside with a blanket and they're arrested by a police officer or cited by a police officer for doing that. So that would not be a violation of the Eighth Amendment under this new decision.
Even if they have no place to go, no city provided, place where they could at least lay down for the night or sleep for the night.
Yeah, the court considered those arguments and rejected them. It's a horribly reasoned decision, in my opinion. It's insulting to human dignity, but it is important to remember that this only applies to the Eighth Amendment. I think there's a lot of misinformation about the case, especially by cities and police. Cities and police think they have a blank check to just criminalize people, and they don't. Unhoused people still have other civil rights and have, disability rights and state, statutory rights and things like that. So it's important to remember unhoused people still do have rights.
Mm. That's important. We're going to talk about one of your cases in that regard involving disability rights. But nevertheless, it's not unfair of me to say that the U.S. Supreme Court has now said that having no place to go, no place to sleep but the streets, is a crime. And yeah. I would certainly agree it's a crime. The fact that it's a crime in the moral sense, the fact that the highest court in the land has said the police can arrest somebody who has no place to go except the streets is pretty shocking. Well, in light of that opinion in Grants Pass, coupled with Governor Newsom's then follow-up executive order, where he directed state agencies to urgently address unhousing people's encampments, which is to say, get them off the street and close down those 10 cities. What can the unhoused do to stay out of jail? What can their advocates like yourself do to defend them? And more to the point, what must cities like Grants Pass or Los Angeles now do in response to the Grants Pass decision and Newsom's order on encampments if our society is to do more than criminalize?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, it's more important than ever for folks who are unhoused to know their rights. Everyone has rights in encounters with police. You have the right to remain silent. You have, rights against being searched and things like that. You have the right to photograph and film police, and you should photograph and film police in public spaces to make sure you document what's happening. If you think your rights have been violated, contact an attorney right away. You can reach out to ACLU SoCal as well. And also it's important that for unhoused folks to know about, you know, their personal property rights. Like, cities cannot destroy people's personal property, even though that's something that happens quite frequently. It's absolutely not allowed, and you know, people need to know that. People can ask for reasonable disability accommodations if folks have disabilities. So it's really important to just know your rights. You know, we have an ACLU SoCal Know Your Rights page up on our website. You can take a look at that. But, you know, standing up for your rights, documenting what's happening, you know, the evidence is very, very important. So make sure to collect all the evidence, you know, get witness information. And in terms of legal advocates, like I said earlier, there are still a number of, you know, constitutional rights and statutory rights that people have. So we have, you know, the Fourth Amendment to protect us against unlawful search and seizure. We have due process, which requires notice and things like that for encampment removals. And then powerful disability protections, too. So,
As a practical matter, though, we're thinking of all those tens of thousands of homeless housed people out on our streets tonight here, or today here in California, 24 hours here in Los Angeles. As a practical matter, are the police arresting any of these folks yet? What has the city decided to do with response to the governor's order that they close down these encampments and so forth?
Yeah, it varies city to city. LA has publicly said that they're not going to do anything differently post Grants Pass. So in the city of LA, we're not seeing particular changes, at least as stated by the, you know, the city itself. But in cities all across the country, we're seeing different responses. And so we're trying to track that. You know, some cities think that they just have, you know, they can crack down on people with impunity now, which is not the case. So, you know, it's important for legal advocates and for unhoused folks to document what's happening so that, you know, we can see what, you know, what these cities are doing and, you know, track any potential violations.
Yeah, but does not the city of Los Angeles run some danger? I applaud them for not obeying this stupid, immoral executive order of Governor Newsom's, but do they not run the danger then of losing some state funding?
Well, so the it's so it's no, there's no, what the city of LA has said is that they're not, they're basically not going to do anything differently than they already have been doing. The city is already being sued by legal advocates on their encampment policies. So there's an ongoing lawsuit, Garcia versus City of Los Angeles, where unhoused plaintiffs are actually still suing the city for destroying personal property. So that's an example of, you know, ongoing civil rights litigation where people are asserting their rights. So the city of LA is far from perfect. They've been sued on many occasions by many, you know, civil rights attorneys, but they've publicly stated they're not going to do anything different than they were before the Grants Pass ruling.
Yeah, no, I understand that, and I do applaud that. But the fact remains that the governor has made that threat. I've seen it in writing.
Well, yeah, the executive order only, so it applies to state agencies, and then it encourages cities to do the same. So it's not legally binding on cities.
Oh, thank you for that clarification. Oh, thank you. Well, that's a little bit better. Let's talk now about one of the victories that you talk about that are still hopefully available out there. You've certainly shown that one of them is. You make the point that the Grants Pass was an Eighth Amendment case about cruel and unusual punishment. Again, it's hard to get your head around that decision. And let's talk about it. It's a victory you've recently had, despite the current legal climate that's rather difficult, certainly for the unhoused. I'm referring to the recent settlement in your case against the city of San Bernardino, having to do with people with disabilities. What were the facts in that case? And what was the settlement reached in the case? And might that victory lead to others, or is it very fact-specific?
We definitely hope this will lead to others, other cases that are similar. But basically, so that lawsuit was filed by unhoused people in the city of San Bernardino. We were representing these individuals last August, and we just reached a settlement. Basically, the suit challenges the city's practice of demanding that disabled, unhoused people comply with these orders to immediately relocate themselves and their belongings. So, you know, people in wheelchairs and walkers literally can't do that, right? You can't pick up all your things, you know, and move in 10 minutes when you're in a wheelchair, for example. And then they were being forced out, you know, into remote areas like ravines or washes where, you know, how are you going to do that if you have a walker? It's just impossible. And so that was a violation of their disability rights under the ADA and other disability laws. And then the city was also systematically destroying people's personal property. So their, you know, medicines, blankets, tents, and much, much more. So that those are the facts of the case. And they're very similar to facts that play out in other cities. So we think these legal claims could apply in many other places.
Good.
And we recently settled it, and we're happy about the settlement. It establishes a new citywide policy that will prevent the destruction of unhoused people's personal property. There's an extensive reasonable disability accommodation section. It calls for a disability coordinator to help intervene to protect the rights of unhoused folks with disabilities. And so this case really is a reminder that, you know, how we can hold the government accountable when they violate unhoused people's rights, especially folks with disabilities. And this applies all across the board. So yeah, it's a reminder that unhoused people do not lose their civil rights, you know, just because they're unhoused.
So am I clear on that? In other words, to the extent that these folks are in a tent or in an encampment, are they allowed to continue that as well or what?
Yeah, so this applies to when you know, the city comes in and does what they call cleanups, what we call encampment removals. And so in order to do that, there are a new city policy that requires notice, requires that if people are going to be displaced, they have to be offered non-congregate alternatives like hotel vouchers. It prevents destruction of personal property. It has an extensive section for reasonable disability accommodations. So basically a new citywide policy. And now comes, of course, the hard work of just making sure the city lives up to what it's promised to do. And that's the next step for us.
Well, yeah, enforcement. How does one in a case like this go about enforcing it? Is it somebody you have stationed on the scene? Do you just wait to hear from your clients as to whether it's being obeyed or not? How does that work?
So it varies case to case, but I try to get out in the field as much as I can and really just interview people, because I think the only way you can really, you know, monitor cases like this is just to get out and talk to people. So I always try to talk to as many people as I can and go out as regularly as I can. We have a hotline that people can call. People can contact the ACLU through our intake form. So, and we pass out Know Your Rights flyers so that people can understand what their rights are and call us if those rights are violated. So we have a bunch of different ways of trying to keep track of the settlement.
Yeah, now, Kathy, you mentioned a website people could go to. At the ACLU, if they're seeking help. Could you give that to us again? I'll write it down and then I'll be able to repeat it again for our listeners as well.
Yeah, it's just our website, aclusocal.org.
Okay, ACLU.
SoCal.org.
SoCal.org.
That's right.
That's wonderful. Now, you participated, I think it was yesterday, at an ACLU-sponsored forum entitled Housing on the Ballot, subtitled, What Would It Take for Us to Solve the Crisis? You and others, therefore, discussed this issue. I wonder, what was your impression of it? What were some of the more interesting or main proposals? Were there any common proposals, for example, put forth by yourself and the panelists to solve the problem? Give us a little report on that meeting.
Yeah, we had a great discussion last night. The panelists all had a lot to say, and I think we had a really productive discussion about, you know, what we can actually, you know, solutions that we can actually achieve, because, you know, we all are aware of the problem, which is this housing crisis that impacts all of us. But, you know, I think solutions are, you know, what we really need to focus on.
What were some of the solutions suggested or that were felt to be obtainable?
Well, I think there's two things. The first one is to get our local governments to divest from causing active harm. You know, and too often our governments are going in and criminalizing people, as we've been talking about. So the first step is getting, you know, local governments in their local budgets to divest from, you know, policing as a first response to houselessness, because that is not the answer. And it's wasting public dollars doing harm rather than helping people. So that's one of the first things. And then divesting from other harmful policies, like, you know, for example, congregate shelter, where, you know, that has uninhabitable conditions and, you know, it is not meeting people's needs. And then the second thing is we know exactly what works to end houselessness. The data is very, very clear on that. And there's two things, you know, housing subsidies for people. The way that you make housing affordable is, you know, provide government subsidies to make it affordable so that people are not paying more than 30% of their income on rent and utilities. And, you know, housing subsidies are the closest thing to a silver bullet we have to ending houselessness.
Again, I'm going to interrupt you only because of our sad time constraints. With respect to subsidies, has anybody done a study and found that, for example, that's more efficient, better culturally, and perhaps saves the government money than building housing for those who are unable to house themselves?
Well, that was my next note, Jim. You read my mind.
Great minds.
Housing first is the other strategy. Is, you know, that's the most effective treatment for houselessness, is providing housing. Decades of empirical research support that. You know, we need to meet folks where they are and provide housing first, and then, you know, supports for folks who need it. And everyone needs something a little bit different. And so, yeah, permanent supportive housing is the gold standard for people who are chronically unhoused, who have higher needs for support. So those two strategies are what ends houselessness. And then we need
I'm sorry, go ahead.
And then we need to prevent houselessness by, you know, preventing evictions and having legal representation for folks in court so that people don't end up on the street, providing cash assistance to renters who need it, basically keeping people in their homes so that more and more people are not being forced out on the street. So we know what works. It's really just a matter of the political will and the movement building to hold our elected officials accountable to doing it.
So let me ask you the $64 question. Is currently the mayor and the city council or the board of supervisors countywide, are they implementing or have they yet implemented any of those good ideas?
Yes and no. So LA County has, you know, over the years done a lot of, you know, good building and strategies, but just not at scale, right? So we have a lot of, you know, we have a lot of past successes, but it's not to the scale that we need. So really that's what it would take, is scaling the solutions we know work, because there's a lot of individual successes, you know, for county programs that have brought people inside into permanent supportive housing and other permanent housing. But it's just not at the scale. So yesterday, you know, we and others were out at the LA County Board of Supervisors meeting advocating to divest from the sheriff's host team, which is not a solution, and invest seriously in, you know, permanent housing.
Well, my hat's off to you on that, because, yeah, I mean, there's individual success stories, but if in fact it was 8%, it's gone up in the last couple of years. If in fact, generally all over the country and here in LA and the county, it's going up, obviously these half-assed measures just don't work. They may work for a handful of people, but they don't work in a systemic, culture-wide, population-wide basis. And that's why the kind of programs that you and others at this panel were advocating make sense. Certainly, I can understand how if you can get the county and the city to stop doing some of these perhaps well-intentioned but useless measures, such as with the police, then there'll be the money maybe to do the kinds of things that need to be done. That's a longer story. And because we have to save a little time for this half hour to do some business, Kath, I'm going to have to just thank you. And I really do thank you. It's hard to think of a bigger problem, a bigger human problem, certainly, facing our country, facing our city and state today than the one you're working on. And working on with some success. And there aren't a lot of successes in this area either. And yet you hold open the promise of more success by some of these victories. There's a great committee. I know great committees and great movement groups, neighborhood groups. We've had them on the show working along with you. you and other guild lawyers and ACLU lawyers understand it. It's what the community thinks needs to be done and how best to do it that often informs what you do. And that's all the better, too. So, Kath Rogers, I thank you so much for joining us today. And Kath, for the work that you and others are doing. It's very encouraging, and I thank you.
Thank you so much, Jim. And thanks for all you do.
All right. Good afternoon. Good afternoon to Kath. That was wonderful talking to her as always. By God, she's wonderful. Listen, before we get to our next topic, though, we've got a little business to do, friends. Fair is fair. We are in our winter fund drive, fall fund drive, winter fund drive. And, you know, we'd only spent 5, 6, 7 minutes a show now doing it. So I'll take it right now. And so that we can not interrupt our next segment too much. You know, our last guest was a good example. It's not an extensive, you know, 20-minute interview with somebody like Kath Rogers. It isn't happening on CNN. It's not happening on the local news even. Maybe you get a little soundbite. That's what we do here day in and day out. We, in our various public affairs programmings, having to do with race, having to do with crime, having to do with immigration, having to do with foreign policy. We do that as well in the Lawyers Guild Show. And we also bring you music you don't plan to hear anything else. And cultural programs you're not glad to hear anyone else. We're part of the movement in LA is the way I try to present it to people whenever we're in our fund drive. KPFK is part of the movement, the progressive movement for social change. That's why Pacifica Radio was invented in the first place, you know, by Joe. That was the whole idea, was to have a radio station that didn't take money from, you know, the corporate sponsors budget. It wasn't advertising Lucky Strikes or anything else. It didn't have to account to anybody but itself and its listeners. And therefore, we can bring you every week and all day long stuff, the voices of people you won't hear anywhere else, telling you how to get involved in these movements, telling you sides of stories about homelessness or the war in Gaza or whatever that you aren't hearing on the corporate media in this country. You don't hear it anywhere but here. And so when you contribute, when you become a member of this radio station, when during our fund drives you pledge $25, $100, $300, $500, whatever you could afford, then you are making a contribution, frankly, to the entire progressive movement in LA. And they have said that. They've said it to me a dozen times, 100 times. They've said it on our airwaves many, many times. All you have to do that is to go, well, you can go to our website. That's easy, kpfk.org. We have all sorts of ways on there that we thank you when you make a contribution with movies and books and what have you. So that's a good thing. But we hope you just appreciate the station and join and contribute for those reasons. You call 818. Now, somebody is talking over me, which is a little distracting. 818-985-5735. 818-985-5735 is the phone number to call. You know that number probably by heart. Please give us a call now or go on our website and make that contribution. That way, you, as I say, you're not just saying thanks. We're not. I really don't want your thanks. I mean, it's nice to get. I want your money. I mean, not me. I want our station to have your financial support so that we can continue doing. And that's how you thank us. When you make that contribution, it's, you know, you're not applauding us. We know, therefore, you're part of the whole progressive movement in LA. We're the voice of that movement. And together we're going to make the kind of changes that our last guest was talking about, but only with your help. We don't get money from the government. We have precious little, and we don't advertise. Archer Daniels Midland doesn't underwrite our show, or the American Bar Association doesn't underwrite this show. 818-985-5735, my friends, is the number to call. Or as I say, go to the website, then you can, you know, with some leisure, look around and see all the thank you gifts. If you contribute $100, you get, if you just want to join us, just to be a voting member of KPFK, that's just $25. Some folks listening right now, I'm rather sure, can afford 10 or 20 memberships. Well, for the people who can't, why not make a contribution of $1,000 or $500? To help your brothers and sisters who may be out of work at the moment. And I know a lot of people, Frank, who are and still manage to send us $25 every time it's membership time. I don't know how they do it, but they're that dedicated to what this station and the progressive cause is all about. So join them, 818-985-5735. 818-985-5735. All right, let's take our station ID break a minute or so early, and then we're going to be back with a woman from Black Lives Matter LA to talk about this new nominated police chief for LA.
Hi, this is Angelique Kidjo, and you're listening to People Powered Radio, KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, and worldwide on the web at www.kpfk.org. If you believe in radio not sponsored by corporations, but sponsored by you, the people, please call and make your pledge at 818-985-5735. That is 818-985-5735. Peace and love.
Well, there you are, friends. We're back with you again after that short break. You're listening to the Lawyers Guild Show. I'm Jim Lafferty. And as I mentioned at the top of our hour, about 30 minutes ago, my co-host and friend Maria Hall is not with us today, but for a very happy reason. Maria couldn't be with us today because she's getting a Hero Award. It's what it's called, a Hero Award from California Safe Schools. Now, this is a group that does a lot of work, especially a lot of environmental work. And making sure that when your kid goes to school, it's got a proper physical environment. We worry about the environment and the rest of the earth. Well, it tends to sometimes we forget about it inside our public schools where our children are going, for God's sakes, and they need to be safe. Well, Maria Hall has done some commemorative and wonderful work with respect to the environmental situation in California schools as part of the California Safe Schools Project. So today, as we speak, she's getting a Hero Award from them. We congratulate Maria Hall, and we'll be thrilled to have her back with us again next week. Well, now on to the matter of this new police chief. The name, the guy who's been nominated, of course, is Jim McDonald. Now, Jim McDonald is a former longtime member of the LAPD. He's a former chief of the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department as well. Also a former chief police of Long Beach, for that matter. And he was one of three finalists for the job that that Mayor Karen Bass had to consider. The other two were Deputy Chief Imada Tingaridis, I hope I pronounced that right, and former Assistant Chief Robert Arcos, who I knew a bit. He left the LAPD in 2021. He's now been working as the head of investigations for the LA County District Attorney George Gascon. But she didn't choose either one of those two. She chose this Jim McDonald. And now it rather seems that McDonald was selected by Mayor Bass, who seems to have somehow abandoned her career-long critiquing of policing culture and her long-term condemnation of police brutality and racism by choosing him, because her nomination goes to the city council now for approval or not. But as the LA Times says, Bass's choice is, and I'm quoting, likely to play well with the department establishment and LA residents who are weary of property crime and a general sense of disorder, close quote. But as you're going to learn shortly, the political movement here in Los Angeles, the political police reform movement here in Los Angeles, has long been opposed to renegade policing and brutal police actions, including the killing of Black and brown residents of our city. For them, the choice of McDonald is not a welcome choice to be our new chief of police. So our guest today, who will explain why this is the case in more detail, is Ms. Paula Miner. Now, Ms. Miner has been a member of Black Lives Matter for many, many years, and she is the head of the Black Lives Matter LA Police Accountability Team. Ms. Miner once worked for the city of LA herself, and she's the mother of three, the grandmother of eight, and she does the work on police reform that she does because, and I quote, "I always hope my activism and efforts in trying to impact policing and the criminal justice system will make changes that my grandchildren and their children will benefit from," close quote. Well, who could want for more than that, for goodness sakes? And why should we accept less Paula Miner, a warm welcome to the Lawyers Guild Show.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm pleased to be here, and I'm pleased that you're sharing Black Lives Matter LA's opinion on this particular situation.
Absolutely.
On your show.
Absolutely. Let's talk about that, if I may, and give you a chance to expound on it. You were kind enough to send me a copy. I'd seen it, but then lost it, a copy of the statement that Black Lives Matter LA issued in response to Mayor Bass nominating McDonald to be the next chief. And one of your initial claims, and talk about that, please, is that her nomination of him, you claim, is a betrayal of the people and a stark contradiction to the progressive values that she claims to uphold. And you point out that McDonald has a long history of anti-Black, anti-immigrant policies. So talk about that in the context of how that seems to be out of keeping with what Mayor Bass claims she's all about.
Yes, yes, certainly. As many people may know, and certainly as members of Black Lives Matter LA know, Mayor Karen Bass was always seen as a progressive. Throughout her career here in the city of Los Angeles, then she went to the California State Legislature, and then she was in Congress before she was elected mayor here. And she was always seen as progressive. She started her organizing, trying to improve conditions and policing in South Central Los Angeles. She even created a nonprofit that still exists, that serves those residents and speaks up for those residents.
Uh-huh.
So many of us believe that the appointment and her lack of really trying to change policing as mayor and her greatly increasing the LAPD city budget, what we call an extreme increase, because as people know, the what they call the usable funds within the city of LA that are not already committed, over 50% of them go to LAPD. And she even made an interim increase in police salaries outside the budget timelines. So we as BLM, you know, we continue to fight for police transparency, accountability, and for the decrease or de-escalation of the harm and the questionable shootings that occur, particularly of Black people, but the excessive and questionable murders by LAPD, even by their own statistics, mm-hmm. are of people suffering mental crisis, which are usually low-income, people of color, and disproportionately Black. All of this leads us to be concerned about LAPD and its leadership, and about Karen Bass's appointment.
Well, that makes sense. And I want to make you give you a chance to be very specific. Your organization in that regard, in what you're talking about, let's explain now. I want to give you a chance to explain why you think, to back up your claim, that Mayor Bass has deviated from what supposedly was her philosophy about all this. You claim that under McDonald's term, the guy she's nominated, when he was L.A. County Sheriff, you claim, the sheriff's gangs, these illegal criminal gangs of sheriff's deputies expanded their terrorism, their killing of community members and their corruption. So let us know why you believe that. I mean, you mentioned, for example, the case of Anthony Vargas and Matrice Richardson. So talk to us about how his record in that department is when he was head of the sheriff's department makes him a long guy for the job.
Yeah, yeah, of course, of course. He was in the sheriff's department from 2014 to 2018. And let me just say this about who he is as we begin to talk about how he operated in the sheriff's department. Mm-hmm. Yes, he started his career at LAPD and he stayed there 28 years. He twice applied to be the chief at LAPD. Once when Chief Beck was appointed, and then again when Chief Moore was appointed, and he, you know, failed, was not selected. He then went to Long Beach to be the chief for 4 years, and then he ran for the sheriff's in 2014 as the LA Sheriff's Department was just trying to recover from so many problems that had been left by our former Sheriff Baca and his
sheriff. Yeah.
So the issue of gangs in LASD, LASD documented gangs have been around for about 50 years. They come up every now and then in various legal and civil cases when individuals are murdered by the sheriff's department and it's alleged that perhaps the person is a member of a gang, or perhaps a community member saw a gang tattoo, or, you know, that just community knowledge. But in the case of Anthony Vargas, most of this is documented. He was killed by killed by the sheriff's department in 2018. This is under McDonald's, under McDonald's service. Mm-hmm. He was shot in the back in a park in East LA. He was attending a family celebration, a birthday kind of celebration in the park. The sheriff's claim he fit the description. You know, that is often used with these questionable shootings. Although later, when evidence was admitted, as the family tried to figure out what was happening and, ask for more information, it was admitted that he had none of the physical characteristics of the person allegedly that they were looking for. Anyhow, the sheriff's deputies who shot him were alleged to be members of the Bandidos gang. And this is a gang that operated out of the East LA Sheriff's Station. Now, there has been some publicity about how that gang was operating under McDonald's reign. Allegedly, some new sheriffs were assigned to the East LA Station and were harassed and beaten because they did not seem to be joining the gang, the Bandidos, or doing what the Bandidos wanted them to do. They sued. It seemed like their suit, you know, was thrown out. But allegedly, these are the people that were running the East LA Station. And the family of Anthony Vargas lived in East LA, not far from that station. They allege that they were harassed, they were followed, they were stopped by sheriff's deputies after they tried to speak out about what they had observed or what they had experienced at that time. What evidence has...
Let me interrupt just because I remember talking, I don't know if it was you or to Melina, to some members of Black Lives Matter. Not only would those original crimes take place, and then when the family members would criticize it, hold a press conference and condemn the sheriffs for doing it, hire lawyers and what have you, and of course the city had to pay millions and millions of dollars for the deeds, misdeeds of these sheriffs, then the sheriffs would go after the family members.
Yes, that's what we're speaking of as sheriff's harassment. That issue is still being considered now. Sheriff harassment of families who have lost loved ones to sheriff's violence. And it's become an issue that's gone before the LA County Civilian Oversight Committee. We have more families than just the Vargas family, but that's the whole issue about McDonald not really trying to attack or even make some changes in the way those deputy gangs were operated.
In fact, Paula, isn't it true that things got so bad, you know, it's always hard to remember history because so much is going on at the same time. But yes. Am I wrong? Isn't it true that the LA County Board of Supervisors finally became so upset when under McDonald's rule, the amount of torture, the amount of the inhumane conditions in the county jail became so bad, they wanted to close down the county jail?
Yes. And some of that, we have to rightfully say, McDonald inherited, inherited it from Baca. But he did little to nothing during that four-year period to make changes. And he ran as a person who was going to make change. He won that election in 2014 because he was supposed to come in and help clean up the situation. The situation in the jail at that time was deplorable. The building continues to be deplorable, not just the treatment, but actually the physical structure that exists, people should not be in that situation. In addition to being unhealthy, in addition to being not up to standards, in addition to being earthquake possibility, there was extreme treatment of prisoners in the jail. There was something that was called prison discipline, where people in the jail were beaten and harmed. Some of them died from these effects. We have a couple of families now who are still speaking out about their loved ones whose death is a result of harm and beating. We have to say beating, perhaps even saying torture, that occurred in the jail. And they identify these situations, you know, correlate. They identify those sheriff's deputies responsible for most of the harm and the beatings as members of sheriff's gangs. The sheriff's department initially in the past, new recruits would be put, their first assignment would be placed in the county jail as the deputies, you know, providing oversight of the jail. And they develop gangs by their floors, like the third street or the third floor boys, or name them. And they let the prisoners know that this is what's going on. This is what was. So it was horrific. The LA Board of Supervisors did vote to close the county jail. They have not closed it yet. They have attempted to restrict the number of people they put in that jail. And right now there is a plan that a lot of people are criticizing because it's so slow, but there is a plan in progress to figure out how to change that jail, how to get people moved out of the jail. So yeah, that he was there, you know.
I know. Another issue that I remember from some work that some friends of mine were doing as well, and I know that this was contained in this statement from Black Lives Matter LA and opposing his nomination, that it has to do with how he collaborated with immigration authorities,
yes,
in carrying out massive deportation sweeps, including targeting, well, undocumented youth.
Yes.
What's about that?
Yeah, that was one of the main reasons he was defeated. He was allowing ICE, that's the Immigration Enforcement Group, the federal immigration known as ICE, he was allowing them to enter the jail to look at their records and basically to remove people from the jail who they thought should be deported. And one of the things about that situation is that many, many people who are in the jail have not been even convicted of whatever particular crime they were arrested for. They hadn't gone to trial. At that time, most of them were individuals who could not post bail. And so they're in jail. He also allowed them to take out what's called undocumented youth. These are people who did not, young people who did not have any paperwork. And he openly said that, you know, when he came in, that he was supposed to make changes. And so this was one of the heavy, heavy factors why he was defeated. And we also have to remember, based on recent histories, he's the only incumbent sheriff that had been defeated when they tried to run again. It's kind of an unusual statistic, but it seems like he carries a record of just not quite doing what you think needs to be done to be a successful member of law enforcement.
Or what he says he's going to do himself, for that matter. Yeah, you know, you also made a charge that I thought was very interesting, because there have been, well, and nobody would know this better than Black Lives Matter in LA or elsewhere in the Black Lives movement. But the wonderful demonstrations that your organization some years back, all over the country, of course, but here in LA, massive, day after day, week after week, sometimes targeting a particular action of the police or the sheriff's department, other times just demonstrating for the fact that historically and currently in the country at large, there is no equal justice for people of color, for poor people, et cetera. But you also therefore make this claim that in nominating him and I suppose the city council is expected to approve it. I don't know. We'll talk about how people can deal with that. But in nominating him, Black Lives Matter LA says that McDonald will likely do all in his power to criminalize political protest and clamp down on freedom of speech. Why do you say that?
Yes, because that is a policy that's moving through the city council, basically through moving through our political system here in LA right now. In late August, two council people introduced a motion that would make it a misdemeanor for protesters to be within so many feet of a person that they wanted to hear their protest, or within so many feet of the radius of a site or location that they were protesting about. And some of this, of course, has come about because of the many, many protests that have occurred this past year about the, you know, the issues in the Middle East between Israel and Palestine, and there have been lots of protests. But yes, it all began back in 2020 when LAPD used very excessive force on protesters, various inappropriate force on protesters. And there is a lawsuit that's still under consideration by the court. BLM LA and other organizations filed that lawsuit, and it's still being considered about the excessive use of force for people who were peacefully protesting. We're talking about peaceful protests here. Mm-hmm. The issue in our city council is really talking about what you say, what kind of literature you can pass out, how close you can be to a building, like if you want to be near the police station or if you want to be near a courthouse. They are restricting those. And it is, as you say, being challenged as a violation of our First Amendment rights. This is one of the things that our city council and our mayor are supporting. And of course, Jim McDonald will be politically approved despite all his various idiosyncrasies. And this is one of the things that we're going to be seeing probably very near.
Is it just considered hopeless? Is it, in other words, I was wondering, I've expressed my opinion, but I'm wondering if people might not want to express their opinion, pro or con, to the mayor's office and to their city council member about how they feel about McDonald being chosen as the new police chief.
Yeah.
Is that being encouraged at all? Or are you working on that issue at all?
We are. We're especially encouraging people to contact their council members.
Yes. Because,
you know, Karen Bass has already taken her stand, so it's passed through there.
Yeah.
The recommendation, it will go to city council. It should go. It is not on council for next week, but it should go in the next couple of weeks. And yes, it is important for people, you know, to make their voices heard with their city council members. That is so important.
Absolutely. Now, how do people get it, if they want to find out more about the work of Black Lives Matter LA, and maybe find out how to go about contacting their council person on this issue of McDonald, what to say? Is there a good website for Black Lives Matter that you would suggest our listeners go to? What is it?
Yes, Black Lives Matter website is blmla.org. And we are on social media. We're on Instagram at BLM Los Angeles, mm-hmm, and on Facebook at Black Lives Matter - Los Angeles. And also, we'd like to invite your listeners to come to our general meeting this Sunday, which is the second Sunday. We meet every second Sunday of the month, mm-hmm, at 7 p.m. at our center, the Center for Black Power. It's at 3423 West 43rd Street in Leimert Park, also known as Africa Town.
Yes. So that would be this Sunday, right? This coming Sunday at 7 o'clock, 3423 West 43rd Street.
43rd Street, yes.
That's right. And in Leimert Park. That is a wonderful park. There have been some amazingly important demonstrations there, and I know you meet there regularly. So listeners, if you'd like to join them, go to their website, of course, but also why not see if you couldn't stop in this Sunday evening at 7 o'clock at 3423 West 43rd Street. And you can go to their website, you know, blmla.org, and find out, I'm sure, more about that meeting and all the other good work they're doing. Well, we've got to leave a few minutes for business again. So, Paula Miner, I want to thank you for, I know, the years and years of work that you've been doing in this area about police reform. It's vitally important. It says a lot about our country that we need to have people like you working as hard as long as you have. It says a lot about our country that we need to have a constant movement, as Black Lives Matter LA shows, to work for that kind of police reform, that kind of elimination of racial and economic injustice. So, Paula Miner, thank you for joining us on the Lawyers Guild show today.
And thank you for having us and allowing us to share our opinion and our information. Thank you so much.
Oh, no, thank you. All right. Well, we just have a few minutes left, a couple of minutes left. I'm not quite sure how long. But I did say earlier before this topic that, remember, this is a fun drive. You can see we don't spend much time talking about it anymore. And that works to our disadvantage, my friends. When we used to spend 20, 30 minutes of every program, well, people claim they hated that. But, you know, you talk long enough and people get tired, I guess, of listening to you harangue. Well, because there's so much going on in the world now, because we're such a singular voice, I mean, this isn't what corporate radio does or corporate TV. We're such a singular voice. We know how important it is at this particularly difficult period of American history to not spend more time than we absolutely must, but we must get your support then in a shorter amount of time. Your role in that is to say, yeah, you don't need to keep haranguing me, Jim. I hear you. I'm making a call to 818-985-5735. Pledging my membership can be as low as $25. And the sky's the limit as to how much if you're doing well. We urge you to do that. I urge you to do that. That when you do it, you're part of this whole movement in LA for progressive cause, for human rights, for the kind of decency we want all of our brothers and sisters to be able to enjoy. You go to our website, kpfk.org, get a little time there. You can look and see all the ways we say thank you. We have a number of, video movies and books and also T-shirts and cups and you name it, that we say thank you when you join us, when you make a contribution, a donation to us. We appreciate that. That's at our website at kpfk.org. But either call us at 818-985-5735 or go to that website. Take your pick. We love it if you say, hey, this is because of the Lawyers Guild show. That's what reminded us to do it. You know, we get a few brownie points for that, I guess. But mainly, I just care that you do it. You'll feel better, I'll tell you. Whenever I make a contribution to the station, and I make it numbers of times a year, our staff is underpaid. Our general manager is working for free, for God's sakes. None of our programmers aren't paid. We're just thrilled to be able to be a part of this important piece of the movement here in Los Angeles. So please be a part of it yourself. As I say, you'll feel better as soon as you hang up that call, because you did make that contribution to us at 818-985-5735, or go to the website when you do. No amount is too small. $25 makes you a full-fledged member. You can vote the various elections we hold for members during the board members of our advisory board during the year. Now the music's going to play, so that means we're out of time. The next program's coming up. You stay tuned. You can make your call while the next program's coming up. Make your call at any time of day and night. Please do it. Next week, the Lawyers Guild Show will be back with you with Maria Hall and myself, Jim Lafferty. Until then, thank you so much for listening today. To those of you that have already called in, thank you, my friends. Thank you. And now you make sure you keep standing up for your rights. I know you don't know what life is really
worth. Is that all that needs are... Let me tell you a story. On June 23rd, 1967, the LAPD beat anti-war demonstrators bloody. Only one radio station in the Southland covered the beatings, KPFK. And that was the day a young kid in Pacoima broke open his piggy bank and joined KPFK. This is Greg Pallas. I was that kid. And for 55 years, I've been a member of KPFK and Pacifica stations. Why? Because the courageous reporting continues. And when other media covers up the news, KPFK uncovers it. Won't you join me? This is Greg Palast asking you to go to kpfk.org. And if you got one of those telephone things, 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK. This is Greg Palast.
Support comes from UCLA Center for the Art of Performance presenting Pie Hole's Disclaimer on October 25th and 26th at the Nimoy. The theater company brings an Agatha Christie-style mystery that